You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. Tonight we'll be talking about issues important to young people. And we've a radical way of doing it. Rather than talking to old people about them, we're going to talk to young people themselves. And with me tonight in studio are Clara Barry and Elizabeth McBride, who are both 16, Jenny Robinson and Tom Symington, who are both 17. We've a couple of oldies in too, although hardly. John Lyons is a former secondary school teacher, now a Labour TD for Dublin North West. And from our Belfast studio tonight, we're joined by long-time children's rights advocate Nora Gibbons, who is also chairperson of the Family Support Agency. You're all very welcome indeed to the programme. And the teenagers here tonight are part of a newly formed group called the Children's Rights Organisation. Earlier this year, they got together to make a short film about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, and that evolved into this new advocacy group. So over the course of the next hour, we're going to talk about their views on various issues, and we're going to talk about the pressures that they feel being a teenager in Ireland today. Jenny, I'll start with you. Do you feel ignored by wider society?
Yes. We feel, well, I think all of us feel ignored in many ways.
In what sense?
In a sense that for bullying, there's a lot of bullying going on, especially cyberbullying. And because no one knows the actual... Well, we know the cause of cyberbullying, but there's no ways around it as of yet because the technology isn't that advanced. Mm-hmm. Hopefully in the future it will be. Ignored in lack of recreational facilities, as in there's nowhere for us to go on a Saturday or Sunday if it's cold out. Everything costs money, which leads us into poverty.
Clara, what about you? Do you feel your voice is heard?
No, I don't necessarily think that the voices of young people are heard, and it's a point that I make all the time when this issue comes up. And, you know, we hear politicians say all the time that young people are the future, but they forget that young people are here today and that we can make valuable contributions to society today, and they're not really helping us to do that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't necessarily think that they know that young people are so capable. They probably think back to when they were young and think, oh, I wasn't very informed when I was 16, 17. They don't realise that young people live in an entirely different world where information is everywhere.
What have you got to say?
Oh, that depends on the young person themselves. But the whole point and the emphasis would be is that every young person does have opinions on everything. And whether they know it or not, young people are very, very political, even if it's not necessarily politics that they want to go into directly.
Liz, what about you? Do you think your voice is listened to?
I'm not sure if it is always listened to, because I feel like teenagers are kind of stereotyped as being grumpy and like lazy, and we're sort of pushed, cast aside by adults, and they kind of have an idea of us. We're referred to as Generation Selfie by the media, and like, you know, like selfishness, and we're all obsessed about ourselves and everything. But I think if adults like gave us a bit more opportunity, then we'd have a lot more to say about, like, we are like the future adults. We have our opinions. We're like basically almost adults, some of us, and we have our own opinions, and we have voices that can be heard.
And Tom, I mean, I know that you set up, you're part of this group, Children's Rights Organisation, and your message is, I suppose, that if you want to know what young people think, just ask us.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. But there's still difficulties with that, in the fact that we don't have the ability to vote. Despite that, there are still laws being put in place that affect young people. And as we don't have the right to vote, that we rely on adults to make good decisions for the betterment of us. And it's very hard for us to have an impact, and that's what we're trying to do now with the Children's Rights Organisation, to target key issues which we feel are most prevalent to young people, and we hope we can have an impact.
You're 17. Would you like to have the vote at 17 or even 16?
That's difficult to say. It really depends, because the education that the government puts in place, in at times you could say it's insufficient. We have education in politics in first, second and third year before the junior cert, but there isn't a great explanation as to the views in politics, such as like left wing, right wing. You don't really understand political parties and political views, so maybe lowering the age to 16, but then whether this kind of a split in opinion in the group between us, but I think probably 16 would be a more appropriate age, despite the fact that there isn't enough education, which is another area that should probably be improved also.
Jenny, what do you think?
I'd actually have to disagree with Tom. I agree with what he's saying with the education system. I do think it should be put in schools that from fourth to sixth year, you should have CSP still. Or even in an SPHE class once a week or whatever, listen to the news, flick on the news, bring in newspapers, get like young children interested in politics before lowering the voter age to give them a vote.
Clara?
Again, I make the point about CSP. I think that not only should it be extended, but it has to be greatly improved. You know, it's not acceptable that CSP is seen as a homework class where you can just take in a book from another subject. And in a situation where we had a better political education system, then yeah, the vote at 16, definitely. Mm.
Because I suppose it's that dilemma, isn't it? I mean, you don't have a vote, and perhaps that's why you feel your voice isn't heard, because you don't wield that influence.
Well, exactly. I mean, if there's one surefire way to get your voice heard, it is to vote. Definitely. It's not the only way, but it's the most easy, concise way that's actually doable. And if 16-year-olds are allowed to vote, it creates a whole new demographic. And I mean, we say now 16-year-olds are not necessarily mature enough to vote. Who's to say 18 is mature enough to vote?
Well, that's the point, isn't it, Liz? I mean, it's not black and white. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, I think I agree with the CSP thing. Like, you really need to improve it. I mean, I know for my third-year CSP class, we just had to memorise the names of ministers and just, like, match up the names. And then we had to, like there were buildings, we had to name the inside of buildings, and it doesn't really give you a good insight into political ideas. It just tells you who they are. It doesn't like tell you what, like not tell you what you should think, but like help you form your own opinions. And
you think it's quite basic?
It's very basic. Mm. It's just kind of like, oh, we're teaching them about CSP, but it's not really, it's just the bare minimum mm-hmm. that they can teach us. Like maturity is a big issue too. I'm 17 now. When I was 16, I don't think I would have known enough to trust myself to vote. And like, even with 16-year-old boys, there are 16-year-old boys out there who still laugh at fart jokes and things like that. They just, I don't know if like we'd be capable to have that
There's
responsibility.
30-year-old men.
Yeah,
exactly. Men who still laugh. John Lyons is laughing, but he's not laughing.
John, what do you make of what you're hearing?
Apart from the last piece about the fart joke, to be honest with you, I'm sitting here thinking, Liz, Clara, Jenny and Tom, you're absolutely massively impressive to sit here and listen to. I had a perception when before I came on tonight thinking, you know, to a certain extent that the panel was going to be ranging from between 14 and 18. And, you know, if we didn't know your ages, we would think you were complete adults, pretty much, by the way you're going on. And I'm just exceptionally impressed, first of all, with the presentation and with the way people are speaking here. It sounds really thought out thoughts, which is what we want people to do, to be able to think for themselves and be able to make informed opinions. And I suppose I'm on here tonight maybe because I'm a politician, but equally I worked as a secondary school teacher for 13 years and was a deputy principal for one of those. And I went into teaching because I genuinely believe that young people are important. And, you know, when you go in with an idea like that, you go in because in some ways you want to right the wrongs of the way your childhood or teenage years were. And maybe, you know, maybe when, for example, when somebody says something horrible to you, whether it be a teacher in the classroom or another friend or a family member or somebody on the road you live in, that you don't want those. You want to in some way kind of protect people from the things that can damage people in order to give them the best possible chance of being themselves as they grow older. And all I would say here tonight at the moment so far, I'm listening to what you're saying, taking on board. You've probably seen me taking down notes here because I'm just exceptionally impressed. There's one thing that I would say is about the CSPE, and I think it was Clara mentioned about, you know, it being used as a homework class. I mean, if it is being used as a homework class, I mean, there are things that, you know, I think you're very articulate, Clara, and I think, as in, you know, there are people, there are responsibilities there, and if somebody's using that as a homework class, I mean, somebody should call it on what's happening there. That's being quite honest with you. Because if I was in the school that I worked in and somebody was using it as a homework class, I wouldn't find that acceptable for any teacher or for any pupil to have to go through that. Or if I was a parent, I don't think it's acceptable. And all of these people play a part in your life and they all have responsibilities too. And as I said, you're quite articulate and I think that you know, that shouldn't be happening. But can I balance out the CSP for a second? I know, you know, Liz mentioned around the matching up of names of ministers and things like that. But there's also a really big important part, as you all know, which is the 60% or the 40%, is it? That's 40% for the project.
40%,
and the project, yeah. The project is actually a bit like what they do in Transition Year with Young Social Innovators, which is kind of like a junior version of getting people to identify an issue in society, try and in some way find out how to address that issue and come up with a proposal, and also look at it as a reflection exercise to see what are the skills I learned. Now, we know sometimes that doesn't happen. But that's what should be happening. And when I was teaching it, that's what was happening.
You're obviously all interested in politics. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't be here. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been involved in this new advocacy group. But Clara, are you interested in getting involved in frontline politics, the type of politics that John's involved in?
Not necessarily, simply because it's an intimidating concept as a young woman to go into somewhere like that where the consensus is middle-aged men in suits. And I mean, I was at EY, I was at an event run by the European Youth Parliament a couple of weeks ago, and I was fortunate enough to hear Simon Harris speak, and he's the youngest TD in the Dáil. And he raised a very interesting point. He said, if you could put a glass ceiling on the Dáil, would you see someone who represents you, someone who looks like you? And the answer for that, to me, is no. And I think that politics will be quite unappealing even to very political young people until they can see people who are not intimidating in the Dáil.
But of course, the answer to that is unless people like you join, then nothing's going to change.
And of course, that's the argument, but you can kind of, there's lots of ways to make that more appealing. You can kind of desensitivize people to women achieving, you know, women achieving so far is kind of synonymous with very, very controversial characters. I mean, unless you're talking about someone like Mary Robinson, then there's a good chance that a lot of people hate them, you know, and that's, it's a very unappealing concept to feel like you could be demonised.
Mm-hmm. Jenny, how do you feel about politicians? Do they turn you off? Are you interested?
Well, I'm not interested, mainly going back to the whole school thing where I wasn't taught it from fourth to sixth year. I personally don't watch the news. I am involved in Dunleer at Down Corlin and Oge. Young Voices, Local Issues is our slogan for that. And basically that is where three representatives from each school around the Dunleer at Down area will come once a month on a Thursday after school. And they're mostly people who are on the student council. And they'll talk to their school and get views from their school of what needs to be done around the area. Mm. And we basically pursue that and try and help it.
That's so politics though, isn't it?
It's politics in a way, but it's not politics as in like European politics and everything like that, mm-hmm. which I wouldn't be interested in.
Why not?
Basically the same. I hadn't been taught it. I have no interest in it because it hasn't been in my background.
Tom, what about you?
Maybe not directly in politics, but as we've been working through with the Children's Rights Organisation, I kind of see NGOs kind of like the Children's Rights Organisation, ISBCC, these kind of organisations which campaign for rights and laws to be made in the Dáil and politics in Ireland. So I consider being involved indirectly, but I can't see myself being involved directly, really. I prefer to have a more indirect role in an NGO.
Would you talk to your friends about the issues of the moment, the national issues, the economic situation that the country is in and those issues like that? Would you have conversations?
Maybe not directly, but you notice the issues coming up, like, for example, poverty. You notice that there's definite differences in schools, but you can see students not being able to afford lunches like that other students are able to afford, not being able to afford the same clothes and stuff. And there's obvious gaps in schools due to poverty and as a result of the economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. And you would talk about that openly with your friends?
Maybe not talk about it openly because there's a bit of a stigma surrounding mm-hmm. it, but it's definitely obvious that it's there and everyone recognises that it's there. Yeah.
Liz, what about you? I mean, do you engage in the issues of the moment with your friends? Is it something you talk about?
It's not exactly. Like, it's stuff that I'm definitely be interested in, but when it comes into talking with, about my friends, I just don't think that we really have like communication about issues that on the news. I do watch the news like on the occasion, but I don't think a lot of my friends do, so we wouldn't really have a lot of discussions about general things that might be affecting us, like youth things. But I showed the children's rights video that we made to a lot of my friends, and they all were like really interested in it. And I'm involved with the website spunout.ie, and I would write articles for that, and I'd sort of show a lot of them to my friends, and I kind of try to get them interested in the stuff that I would be interested in too. But it might take a while to get them all turned on to the same stuff.
Nora Gibbons. Nora, you're very welcome to the programme. You're listening to us in Belfast this evening. As I say, you're a long-time children's rights advocate. You've been listening to the young people here this evening. Do you agree that their voice is lost, generally speaking, in Irish society?
Yes, Audrey. Good evening, everybody. I had the pleasure of hearing these young people and indeed some more of their friends when they launched their video. And it was just an excellent video and something I wished I had years ago when I tried to talk about children's rights. To have had a video that was made by young people explaining what it meant to them would have been excellent. Having said that, yes, I think our history in Ireland, and indeed the history in Europe generally, is that we were not ever good at listening to the voice of children or hearing them. We viewed them as property, we viewed them as something we owned, and we didn't think that they had anything important to say. And it wasn't, Audrey, people are surprised to hear that it wasn't even studied. Nobody looked at the notion that you would even ask them. And if we look at the history of education, it was right up until 1921 before education continued until 14 in England. Before that, children worked. And in Ireland, it was 1968 before we had free second level education. So I think those kind of things tells us that children were something that we saw as property. We didn't see them as persons. Then, and one of your young contributors there spoke about it, Clara, I think, we saw children as something for the future, not as people who is here now with us. And the other thing that we thought about, said about children, they said that we were kind of, they were troubled and troublesome, and we were only bothered about them if we felt that they needed something, so that was a charity thing, or indeed if they were getting into trouble, at which point we locked them up for a long time. So their voices were not heard. Recently, I think we've begun to understand very much from young people themselves that we have lost out on a wealth of their own experience, and that we have lost out on hearing the voice and the views of the actual people whose lives we are trying to improve.
Well, look, between now and 11 o'clock, we're going to discuss some of the specific issues facing young people today, from themselves, the pressures that they're facing, and also their futures. Do they see their futures here in this country because of the economic situation that we're experiencing at the moment? And Jenny and Tom, you're both 17, so you're both, you know, in your leaving cert year. Tom, do you have any idea at this stage what your plans are?
It's very difficult to say because, you know, you're still so young at 17, you don't really have a great grasp on what you want to do. And it makes choices for the future quite difficult to make. And like, will I be able to get a job in Ireland? But I tend to be quite optimistic in that regard. I really don't have much idea of what I want to do yet. I'm kind of just, you know, getting experiences like this through the children's rights organisation and getting a kind of grasp on what areas I'd be interested in.
Would you like to travel though and see the world?
Yes, I would, but I'd be more inclined to stay in Ireland. But I'd also like to travel the world.
Jenny, what about you? I mean, are you thinking now that you will probably have to emigrate, or might there be a future for you here?
Yeah, I agree with Tom completely. I do think 17 is really too young to make a decision on your whole future. Myself personally, I am looking at a course at the moment of business and arts management. And hopefully through that, I'll be able to do event management or a theatre background. I'm thinking for event management, I'll probably have to emigrate because, where'd you get a job in that in Ireland? But hopefully won't have to.
Mm. What about you, Clara? You have another year to go.
Yeah, I have a lot more time than Jenny and Tom, fortunately for me. I'm one of these people who gets less and less sure every time I have an experience because I'm very much someone who, you know, enjoys having a toe in every pool, but I'm kind of more sure of what I'm not interested in than what I am at the moment. I'm actually looking into a career in chemistry, which could quite possibly mean emigrating.
Mm-hmm. And how would you feel about that? I mean, would you do it reluctantly or would you embrace it?
In some ways, I'd embrace it. I mean, eventually, I would like to return to Ireland if there was jobs and work here. But I'm quite happy to float around for a bit beforehand.
Do you have faith in this country?
I do, but I think that it'll have a lot of collateral damage. And I think that, unfortunately, our generation will be a lot of that collateral damage.
Liz, what about you?
I kind of have that sort of little kid dream of being a writer when I grow up. I don't really have a proper plan, but I do know I want to study English, I think, and with views to becoming maybe a screenwriter or a journalist or something mm-hmm. to do with writing. But my mum's from America, so I have dual citizenship, so living in America has always been something that, like, an option for me. So I think, like, that's maybe the route I'll take, but I can't really tell yet. I have a cousin who she went to Trinity and she was, like, amazingly smart and she studied zoology and that's, like, the thing that she does, but she can't find a job at all. And she's one of the most, like, deserving people of a job. She's so intelligent. She studied for years, but she can't find a job here. And I think it's just unfair that she has to stay here and she can't do what she wants to do. And I don't know if she's thinking about emigrating or whatever, but I think it's important to have faith in your country, but if it's keeping you from making a living, I think then you have to leave.
Jenny, I mean, because it's often said that your generation and, you know, those leaving college at the moment, that effectively the country has written you off in terms of having something here to keep you, to make you stay, to encourage you to stay. I mean, do you worry about that?
Yeah, definitely, especially because I'm so close to the leaving cert and having nowhere to go after, no jobs, is just so hard to think about, especially during the recession as well.
John, what do you say to all that?
To be quite honest with you, I was thinking when Tom kind of hesitated about maybe feeling unsure or almost apologetic maybe inside that he didn't know what he wanted to do, and I was just sitting there kind of thinking, do you know what? I don't think any 17 or 18 year old should be pushed into saying what they want to do. That happened in my life, happened in everybody else's life up until now, and I just think it's let people be people for a while. And you
and
know,
I just think that there's so much going on in teenagers' lives at
absolutely.
That age to throw the leaving cert on top of them. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's huge pressures on young people, and there always have been. But I think, you know, I wouldn't like to be a 17 or an 18 year old in this world right now because of the new types of pressures, you know, with new technology and so on, and all the other added pressures of living in 2013 as such, whether it's in Ireland or anywhere else in the world, because it's a different place. And but I would feel really strong around that. I really don't think we should be asking young people to make a decision on the rest of their life when they're 17 or 18, and it's wrong to do so. And I think we can find ourselves a little bit better. And I remember Professor John Coulihan, who would have been the professor of education when I was trying to be a teacher. And when I think it was when Nora was speaking, she said, we don't see, you know, young people as people. We see them as commodities or property. And I remember him, John Coulihan, saying, you know, we need to let children be children. We need to let them grow up in their own time, and instead of forcing these structures on them, which a lot of the time weren't right. And like, for example, I just think it's an absolute miracle how people in the past, not so much now because we're moving away from with the education system and we are definitely moving away with the new junior cert, but how a young person was asked to sit from 9 o'clock till 4 o'clock behind a desk and behave themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that's miraculous that we get young people to do that, because that's not the place where learning occurs. It's in a very different way, and hence why I went into teaching in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's about getting up, experiencing it, putting your hand in the water and feeling it rather than being told about how cold it is. And I'd agree with what lots of Nora was saying there. But one thing I would say is I'm somebody who has faith in this country and have faith in young people. And we are doing things, albeit within kind of not perfect times, to try and ensure that there are reasons why young people should feel faithful to Ireland and patriotic and want to stay here. But it's not an ideal situation we find ourselves in either.
Nora, what do you think?
Well, I suppose the first thing that struck me was just how sad it was to hear a young person said that they felt that they were collateral damage. I mean, we've all had a shock, I think, an absolute shock to the system, a shock to us as human beings the last 6 or 7 years in Ireland because of the recession. And there is no doubt at all that the young people that are sitting there, young people of that age and their children and the generation above them, they're all going to pay for what went wrong for the last number of years because the country is left with massive debt. But I, like John, have great faith in the country, yes, but also in the people and the young people. And while I think it is challenging to be young today, it's always been challenging to be young. There were different types of challenges. But the people who will see their way out of that are the young people themselves, and they will build their way out of it. Because that's what we do in order to continue the human race. Each generation is faced with new challenges and they find answers. I think children and young people, for example, in poverty have taken the brunt of the recession. Families with children, particularly those families who might be on social welfare, have over the last number of 6 or 7 budgets lost more relative to what they have. It's not percentages, it's the actual pounds in your and shillings in your pocket, or the euros nowadays, I should say, just not to show just how old I am. And just to say as well, so that's the reality. And I think now that things have started to look up in the country, really one of the things the government has to do is deal with the people who are in consistent poverty. Over 104,000 children and young people, start dealing with that bit by bit so that we can give them some kind of scaffold, some kind of base to deal with the problems as they go forward. And listening to those young people, and I mean this very sincerely, I have no doubt but that they will do that. Mm.
John Mayo has texted in saying, why are our young people the worst in Europe at languages? I think they should spend most of second and third level abroad where they would think, live and speak the language. And Clara, maybe you'd address this one. Jim in the West says, most of my class emigrated in the 1960s to America and to England and were working on the building sites at 17 years of age. Travel was only one way and the only communication with home was by letter. All these lads were very successful in life. He thinks the teenagers nowadays seem to be mollycoddled a lot.
Well, that'd be a very conscientious issue. Yeah, definitely teenagers to a degree are mollycoddled, but I am no doubt that teenagers have always been looked after, not necessarily by a society on a more kind of individual level, but I mean, the whole focus of the Leaving Cert, you hear it, I'm in fifth year and I'm hearing it now, is focusing on like self-learning. You know, you are very much taught how to... Well, you're basically told that you have to learn how to learn and how to develop your own opinions and stuff. It doesn't necessarily work, but that's what you're told. And I don't think that teenagers are mollycoddled to a detrimental extent.
Okay. Well, look, we're going to take a break from you for the moment, for the next few minutes or so, because earlier today, our reporter, Richie Byrne, went to Crumlin Boxing Club in South Dublin, and he talked with two young people there. First up was 17-year-old Nikita Campbell.
On the bags, full game for 10 seconds. Let's go. 10, 9, 8.
I used to live, when my mum and dad were together, they used to live out on the north side, and then she had two other kids and we all came over here then to Crumlin. So I've been here 13 years and I've been called ginger, slagged and all, and I've dyed my hair over the past few years as well.
What colour is your hair now?
It's brown now. It was kind of strawberry blonde when I was younger, and it picked on me because I'm in a school for special needs and they'd call me retarded and call them horrible things. You'd get picked on walking down the street and they'd stop and call you retarded. So I've been growing up with that since I moved to Crumlin with my mum. I have a learning problem, like my maths and my English. I can't read some particular books and I can't spell some words, and because of the name of the school they call it retarded.
How does that affect you?
It makes me feel stupid when people are saying that stuff to me. They make me feel down on myself that they just pick on you for no reason, and they used to egg my house and all that.
Has boxing helped you with that?
Yeah, it made me feel back up myself, like because I'm doing something and they're very nice in here and it makes me feel like I've been a part of it for a long time.
When are you doing your Leaving Cert?
This June, coming.
You're doing your Leaving Cert in June?
Yeah.
And what do you think you'll do after that? Or do you think there's any opportunities for you? Because, I mean...
Well, I'm going straight to college. I wanted to do childcare, but I'm going to do catering now after school.
And do you think there's any opportunity for you here, or do you see yourself immigrating? Or?
I'd like to stay here, but there's nothing here, no jobs. I feel if I was to ever have a kid, I wouldn't stay here, because I feel like when I'm older, everything's going to drop and you won't afford a house and you won't afford your kids' clothes and the car to travel around and the petrol's going to go up and the diesel. If I wanted to have a kid, I'd go somewhere else and bring it up in a nice and safe place. I wouldn't want my kid to be slagged over nothing, and I wouldn't want to see my kid the way I grew up.
2, 1, hands up, elbows in, chin down, face your back.
Michael McCoy.
Michael McCoy, where are you from, Michael?
Crumlin.
And what age are you?
14.
How important is a club like this to you in your daily life?
Well, it gets me off the streets and they bring me away. We have a lot of fun. Like, it's not, you don't be thinking about anything that happens on the streets. You're able to clear your mind and be able to just let everything go and learn new stuff.
What's the one thing you would wish the government would do or would listen to from young people?
Make more like facilities for people to play in. And I was walking to school this morning and there was a lot of people at the barn and stuff, and people's outside people's gardens, which is at the room in their garden and stuff.
And these are all young kids, are they?
Yeah, they're around 11 or 12.
You think if there's more facilities, it would help people go off the streets?
Yeah, well, there's an MMA club around the corner from where I live, and there's a lot of the kids around where I live after getting into it, so it's kind of dragging them off the streets as well. And I think it's fun, because I do it sometimes in the mornings.
What's an MMA club?
Mixed martial arts. It's like Brazilian jiu-jitsu and all that type of fighting. Like, I've seen a lot of people drinking and taking drugs, and they're younger than me. I'm only 14.
Really?
Yeah.
And what do you think their future is?
If they keep going the way they're going, I don't think there's a life for them.
How do you see your future, your life?
I have to see how I get on in school and see if I can go to college, try and make it up to college, and because I want to be a vet when I'm older, so.
You want to be a vet?
Yeah.
And do you think you'll end up staying in Ireland, or do you think you'll go abroad?
Well, I'd like to go over to Canada to do a veterinary course, because we have a lot of animals. I've grown up around them. We have dogs, rabbits, pigeons, horses, fish, everything.
In your house?
Yeah, we've some out the back. We have horses down the country and that.
Do you think animals are a good thing?
Yeah, they're the only other thing that clears your mind if you're in a bad humour, and you can go out and sit there and just look at them and just clear your head.
Interesting thoughts there from Nikita Campbell and 14-year-old Michael McCoy. They were at Crumlin Boxing Club in South Dublin today talking to Richie Byrne. And just picking up there on some of the things Nikita was saying at the start, the bullying that she faces. I mean, it's very difficult to listen to, never mind to deal with. And Liz, is this a big issue, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think it affects everyone. Like, I don't think anyone doesn't know anyone who hasn't been affected by bullying in directly or indirectly. Just what she was saying there, it's really cruel. It can be, like, really obvious like that, like, really obviously hurtful, but a lot of the times you see it as being really subtle and really sneaky, so it's kind of hard to distinguish, like, if someone's bullying or if someone's just having a laugh, and it's really hard to do that. I think in my school anyway, there's a lot of playful teasing and a lot of messing, but it can kind of border on hurtful, and there's a really fine line between the two, and I don't think you can really, there's no way that you can really tell that if you're crossing it or not. It's sort of, it's very, very hard. It's very what's a delicate line that you can
exactly
cross.
It's a very fine line, isn't
yeah
it?
It's very, very fine, and it's just such a huge issue in Ireland and the world, basically, with not just verbal bullying but cyberbullying as well, like Facebook, Ask FM, Snapchat, Twitter. There's all these mediums that we communicate without even speaking to each other, and especially with Ask FM, it's all anonymous. It's all, no one can really tell who you are unless you get an IP address, and that's just a whole issue. And Facebook privacy settings, they're changing the privacy settings, aren't they? And it's just really, it's easy for people to kind of find you. It's like they don't really remind you that everybody can see it. There's like one reminder on Facebook that when you're posting something, it's like everyone can see this, and there's none on the mobile app that it doesn't tell you if people can see it or not. So it's kind of, it's easy to put yourself out there and not realise that you are.
And when people say, you know, if that's happening to you, specifically online we're talking about, if that's happening to you, then the person being bullied should just, you know, stop going online. That's, is it as simple as that?
It's easy to say that in theory, but I think in practice it's very difficult to put words out of your mind. You know, they kind of stick around forever in your head. They kind of don't leave. So maybe, I've never been on Ask of Them. I've never been affected by cyberbullying myself, really. But I think the mentality of someone, they don't really want to give up, or they don't want to seem like they're giving in. But I think if you are really affected, then it's not just to walk away, but it's to speak out about it. And there seems to be a bit of a stigma attached to speaking out about having problems. It sort of makes it seem like you're weak, or if you're a telltale or whatever, and people don't want to be seen like that, or they don't really know who to talk to. But there are innumerable people that you can talk to, really. There's teachers, students, friends, anyone. There's, and it should be more widely known that there should be no stigma.
That exactly. And Tom, are those systems in place? Because as Liz was saying there, I mean, it is a very isolationist thing to be bullied.
Exactly, yeah, that's the thing. And I suppose a lot of the issue with cyberbullying is that we've always been told to go to a teacher if you're having trouble, but teachers don't really understand how social media works nowadays and how students can interact at any time. They can be contacted anywhere. It's not just at school that bullying can occur. It's now it follows you home. But I suppose the idea would be, ideally, if there was like student councils of anti-bullying ambassadors, members of students in the school, senior students who could be a way for these students to address their problems, and then these students, these anti-bullying ambassadors, could then talk with the school staff, and they could solve the issue. And to be honest, I think teachers don't fully understand. And even if you're able to build up the courage to talk to a teacher about bullying issues that you may be having, teachers won't know how to solve it in this age of cyberbullying.
Liz?
And just like the extent of our school's policy on bullying is basically one sign in our school saying our school does not tolerate bullying in any way or form. That's it. They tried to implement this thing where they took up questionnaires every 2 weeks, and then you put them in the box, and the questions are basically, have you been bullied in the past 2 to 4 weeks? Have you seen anyone being bullied in the past 2 to 4 weeks? And it was never really followed through on. And we haven't done it since last year, really. And that was kind of, it sort of started strong. It was a good idea, but it sort of petered out after a while. I think a lot of measures to combat bullying are like that. They're kind of, oh, it's great at the start. And then at the end, it's kind of, they lose their heart in it. They just kind of, their heart's not in it anymore. They kind of just let it fall apart. And that's really problematic, I think.
Clara, what's your view on this?
It's a really, really, really important issue that we need to tackle. And I mean, I think that the anti-bullying student ambassadors is a fantastic idea, personally. I mean, I'm a prefect for first years at my school, and obviously it's flagged with us as an incident, but quite simply, it's not enough. And when you're 12, 13, and it's, you know, someone in your class that's picking on you, you really don't necessarily want to go to a teacher. And especially if it's cyberbullying, because one has to consider that if you're cyberbullying someone, you can be completely anonymous. You can be waking them up in the middle of the night with texts coming from private numbers. You can basically inflict mental torture upon someone and not have a name or a face to it. So there needs to be more strict measures in place to stop that.
And where does that come from? I mean, it should be top down, but we've heard from Liz there that some individual schools are just not following through on it.
Well, in terms of in individual schools, it's really important to tackle face-to-face bullying, because that's the most obvious bullying that we see. And I hear horrific incidents of bullying. I mean, my friend, he had a school bag full of textbooks dropped on his head from a height, and he was knocked unconscious. And very little was done by the school. And I think that it's completely unacceptable. And I think legislation might even be the answer to actually make schools do something about it, especially when someone ends up in hospital for 3 days. As in that case, that's exactly what happened. And that was the second major incident of physical bullying. Previously, he'd had his collarbone fractured by the same people. So
I know. Jenny?
Yeah.
I think it's... most schools do have an anti-bullying policy, but they don't act on it. It's like, say, bullying is all hyped up around media and everything when someone commits suicide, but a person that, like, the little shove in the corridor isn't, like, relevant, as relevant as suicide, but that's how everything starts. Like, you have to get it at the starting point before it leads on.
Would you say this is, because I think you say this, Liz, that bullying is the biggest challenge facing teenagers?
Yeah, I think it is, like, more so than, I mean, they're all really huge in everybody's lives, poverty and access to recreational spaces, but bullying is definitely one of the major ones. Mm.
John, what do you make of that?
First of all, on just bullying in general, it's one of those kind of hidden things sometimes that happens, or at least starts off, I think, you know, very low level, in places where sometimes people don't see it. And obviously, as some of you said already, it can take a lot of courage for somebody to actually come forward and actually admit it. And sometimes they never do, and it moves to a very detrimental stage then after that. I think it's hard to go through this world without being bullied, and that's not acceptable. I'm not using that as an excuse. You know, just give you one tiny example. As TDs, if you were to go home and look at most TDs' Facebook pages, you would see elements of, there's one thing, somebody having an opinion, but when they have more than an opinion, it's into some of the things that some of teenagers experience, except it's happening to adults all across. But what I would say is that, you know, somebody who worked as a teacher as well, so I'm just using that example, I know that back in September that there was a new circular sent out, which is a kind of information instructing schools from the department, from the Minister of Education, on the new anti-bullying procedures that all 4,000 primary and secondary schools have to follow. And one of those things is, it's about, as somebody mentioned there already, about nipping it in the bud, preventing it, so that they're being told that they must create, you know, a kind of an inclusive, positive culture within the school in order to prevent bullying from happening, or at least to minimise it. And then one of the other things is that every school now has to have their bullying policy online, so that all parents and all students can see it. And that's where it comes in as well. That, I mean, it is a consistent approach. I mean, everybody has to get on board, the student, the teachers, the other people working in the school community. Everybody has to get on board. And I know, I think it was Belong To in relation to homophobic bullying has some really good videos on their website in relation to, you know, some people. And one of the things was about how other people within the school stood up for that person too. And the video itself was very, very powerful and very, very touching. Now, I know I'm talking about very blue sky stuff, but it does require, you know, a huge effort from every single person in order for it to happen. Can we eradicate it? I think in today's world, it's becoming ever increasingly difficult, but I think we can do a lot to minimise it. But I do think those new guidelines that came out for a national anti-bullying policy for schools are very important, and there is a big onus on the school community to ensure that they do everything they can so that school is a safe place for everybody coming. I'll give you like one tiny example. My niece, she's in second year, she wouldn't go to school the other day because there was a non-uniform day, and she was afraid people would cheer up because of the clothes she wears. That's not acceptable.
Nora, I'll get your views on this and put this text to you from Anne. She says, I know a child who was in torment from bullying in the school and the school did nothing. Then the child's parents moved her to another school where every parent and student attending that school had to sign the zero tolerance contract before being accepted as a pupil, and that child found no bullying in the new school. The children take their lead from the adults around them.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that I was just noting there as the young people spoke, the notion that somebody would be assaulted at school, which is a criminal offence, and that nothing was done about it by the school, is just a shocking dereliction of duty. There's an onus on every school to exercise a duty of care to all those children in their care. And it is absolutely correct, and I think John, again, with the young people, has put the finger on it. It's something we all have to get involved with. You can't say this is always going to be with us. We said that about lots of things. But the minute that a school takes this seriously, no good putting something in place and leaving it. Take it seriously, set up projects. I like the idea very much of the student bullying ambassadors, because when I talk to young people, or young people have spoken to me about being bullied, and you ask them what they want it to stop. They don't want necessarily anything more serious to happen about it, if only it could stop. But in order to stop it, I think adults have to model the behaviour. Adults themselves must not bully within the school setting or in other settings. They mustn't demonstrate bullying, and they must come down hard, I think, on bullying behaviour and point out that it's wrong, because young people and parents talk to you about bullied, but there are, it's the young people as well who are doing the bullying. And I think we have to deal with both ends of the spectrum. For children out there and their parents who don't know what to do, I would remind people that if they've gone through the local systems and it's not working, the Ombudsman for Children, Emily Logan, is there, who will certainly be able to offer some advice and able to take things to a different plane if, in fact, the schools are not following what they've been asked to do, what is now the law of the state to do in relation to bullying.
Clara, we've been talking about bullying for the last 10 minutes or so, and Liz has described it as, she believes, the biggest challenge facing teenagers today. Bullying aside, what other pressures are there? Do you feel huge pressures being a teenager today?
Yeah, there's plenty of pressure. I mean, there are probably pressures that wouldn't have been around for teenagers in the 80s or the 90s or, you know, very recently, but the pressures of basically being able to find a career and make money in this country, the pressures of the concept of emigration, the pressures of actually how you look is a really, really big, big issue. The pressures of kind of the way you're seen in general is a really big deal. And then
by your peers.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can have friends and still be looked down upon by your peers, which is a really strange, it sounds a really strange concept. But the whole concept that we can label someone as, you know, off the wall or odd or, you know what I mean, or ostracize someone because they're not like us, that's scary, in my opinion. And it's not even necessarily that I would class it as bullying, because it doesn't necessarily feel like bullying, but to kind of feel that you have to fit a certain status quo is scary. Mm-hmm.
And when you say the pressures of how you look, you have to look a certain way. What do you mean?
Well, I mean this whole, and it's come up so, so many times, I don't even want to say it, thigh gap. You know what I mean? This whole slim stomach, you know, skinny legs, this, that and the other. You know, there is massive pressure to be that. And even if you're not directly, you know, having negative comments about that, you're still completely insecure about it because you don't necessarily look like other people. Despite the fact that you know that those people don't, like, they're much below the average dress size, mm-hmm. and that you're probably closer to the average yourself, it's still hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Liz?
Also about, not just about being skinny, there's a lot of pressure, I mean, a lot of stuff that I see, like abuse towards people who are skinny, and saying, you know, curvy is real, you're not real if you're not curvy. And I just think, like, if you're too big, you have to be skinny. If you're too skinny, you have to be bigger. It's like, there's who decides this? It's like, yeah. It's some unwritten kind of
totally agree.
Rule.
It goes both ways.
Yeah, and it's such a weird double standard for, it's like, it's just really, it's really hard. Like, you can't be any size without having criticism. So, like, these days, even if you're skinny, you're kind of, like, looked down upon, like, oh, she's anorexic. Mm. Or, and, like, they're obviously not. You're just, like, normally skinny. It's just, it's really, it's just nasty. You can't win either way.
Do you feel that as well, Jenny? And maybe you would talk about the impact then that has on girls. I mean, I'll ask you, Tom, is it a female thing more than a male thing? But you first, Jenny.
Yeah, coming from a female point of view, I would say, yes, it's more female than men because of the whole mass media type and the perfect woman and how some men like their women curvy, but to women, if you're curvy, you're fat and all this. I know it is there for men as well. I'm not saying it's not. I just, from a woman's point of view, I do feel it's more women.
And what effect does that have, Liz?
It just is, you don't really know what to think. Like, you're kind of, am I all right? Am I too big? Am I too skinny? And it's like, it's like so many standards that people have for you. I think the reason that girls are so much more affected by it is just like the whole society thing. Mm. Girls are valued on their looks. men are valued on like intelligence, their minds or whatever, and it's preconditioned girls to only see each other in terms of our appearances, and it's just stressful. We're so much more than our body sizes, I think.
Exactly. Tom?
Yeah, I would agree with that, what everyone has said, really. But I feel that standardised systems in schools could go a long way to solve this, as in school uniforms and stuff, to solve the discrimination if you feel you're not wearing clothes that... If you're not going to go in for a non-uniform day because you feel you'll be bullied because of the clothes you're wearing, that's just completely out of order. Like, standardised uniforms could go a long way to save this. It's a cost-saving measure. It avoids discrimination. And it prevents you from being judged on what you wear. So that could go a long way, along with standardised lunches, which could target the same issues.
Yeah, exactly. What pressures do you feel as a teenager?
Well, I suppose... the main one that everyone talks about, being in sixth year, in my final year of school, is the Leaving Cert, and with study and expectations from your parents, expectations from your school, expectations from your peers. But there's also, like Clara said, appearance, expectations for getting a job after college, even further on. So there's just enormous pressure on young people. But I have to say, exam pressure is probably...
the biggest
the
one
most prevalent,
at the moment,
yeah.
Okay, 7 minutes to 11. We've very little time left and we have to take a break, so we'll talk again in a minute. RTE Radio 1. You're very welcome back to the programme, debating issues that are important to young people with young people on the programme tonight. We've about 3 minutes left. I suppose we'll spend the last 3 minutes talking about influences on your life, because we often hear other programmes talk about, you know, role models, and role models are so important for young people today, we're told. Clara, who would you say is the greatest influence on your life?
Well, my parents have a massive influence on my life, what I'm interested in, what I do. A lot of, like, my musical taste and my ambitions come from, you know, dreams that my parents would have kind of talked about and instilled in me from when I was very young.
Liz, what about you?
I have so many, I don't even think I could list them, but my parents are definitely a huge main one. Both my parents were interested in journalism, which is how I kind of sort of have the writing gene. So, I get one of the main reasons I sort of became involved in all the things that I've been involved with, the children's rights and everything, is due to Spun Out, the website I did work experience on in transition year. And John Buckley is the kind of
go-to
guy.
Shout out to John,
love you.
You know John very well.
He's my life.
That's a really good
I hope he's listening.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, love
I'm
you.
Sure he is.
He's like everyone at Spun Out, Marie and all of them, but they've all been, like, they've got me involved in so many things that I never thought I'd be involved in. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily politically minded. I was never really politically minded, but I've learned a lot more, like, through my own incentive because of them, so I'm really grateful for that as well.
Jenny, who's your greatest influence, would you say?
to sound something, I'd actually say my mum, because she does so much volunteer work and everything, which is how I got into it. She started a youth club for children and young adults with special needs 10 years ago. We have our 10-year anniversary today, this year. And I've helped out with that for the last 10 years, and just all the volunteer work that she does is amazing.
Tom?
I suppose my parents are a big influence on me, but I'd have to say being in school from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, teachers are a massive influence on you. And if you can have bad relationships with teachers, and which can put you off an area, so they do have a massive influence on you, and... Good experiences with your teachers can really help you in life, I think.
Yeah. And Nora, presumably you would agree with that. And listening to them all here, it's really encouraging to hear those strong relationships with families too.
Oh, yes, it is. And in fact, it bears out what we know now from a big report that came out, I think, Audrey, it was just 2012. It was called The State of the Nation's Children. And that talked to a lot of children and young people, and the vast majority were doing well. they had good rapport with their parents and they had good involvement in their community. And interestingly, they identified precisely the same kind of issues that the young people who were involved with the Children's Rights Organisation identified.
Okay. Nora, look, we have to leave it there. We're out of time. It's been a really interesting discussion from all our points of view, I think. Thank you all very much indeed for taking part. To Clara Barry, Elizabeth McBride, Jenny Robinson, Tom Symington, John Lyons and Nora Gibbons. We're back with more 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Until then, from all of us, good night.